Log Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. Our guest this morning, depending on what part of the world you're in, I guess, is Gerard Artson. He has a great book, Here to Help, UFOs and the Space Brothers. We're going to talk about that, I think, during the first 30 minutes of the show. And then in the last 30 minutes, I'd like to get into the ageless wisdom teaching. And I'd like to welcome Gerard back to the show. Gerard, it's been a while since we talked. How have you been?
It has been, Mark. Thank you for having me again. It's always a pleasure to be on your show. I've been getting better, actually, after a long drawn, I don't know, thing with my lungs, and I'm trying to recover from an infection now, but and I apologize to you and the listeners if I'm not at my best today, but I'm sure we'll manage.
Well, you sound really good, and as we were talking before the show started, I'd also like to get you on somehow. I'm not sure how we're going to be able to do it, but I'd like to get you on Revolution Radio, which is kind of a network of radio shows, radio show hosts, and we got a bigger audience there. So hopefully we can do that at some future date, some way. Gerard, I know you're in Europe. Is it Holland, Sweden? I always forget where.
Well, they're all the same, of course, but I'm in Holland.
Holland, okay. Well, at least I remembered, kind of.
Amsterdam, Holland, actually.
Excellent, excellent. And last night I was rereading some of your book, and I was also watching a YouTube video that you had done. You were speaking, I guess English is your first language, is that correct?
No, it isn't, no. No, we speak Dutch in Holland.
And excellent.
English.
So you were doing this interview in English. I don't know if you were in the U.S. or where you were, but it was very interesting.
Yes, I write in English. I do interviews in English. I teach in English. I do basically everything in English.
Amazing. What is your personal website? Do you have one?
My personal website is bgapublications.nl. It's also in English. BGA for Bernard, and then GA, my initials, publications.nl.
Is it your own publishing company?
Well, it's not even a company. You need a legal body in order to apply for ISBNs, and I self-publish my books, so I had to register as a publishing company, also with publish on demand providers. So that's what I did, and
very interesting.
It looks good on the books, BGA Publications.
Yeah, it does, and they're very well done.
Thank you.
On page 45 in your Here to Help UFOs and the Space Brothers, you talk about a very fascinating event that occurred in 1961 where an unidentified craft landed nearby the Pope. A being stepped out of the ship and the Pope started talking to the being. The Pope was Angelo Giuseppe Roncalli. I don't know if I pronounced his name right. He was also known as Pope John Paul the 23rd, and I think the Pope...
No, John the 23rd. John the 23rd.
John the 23rd.
Popes John Paul named themselves after both Popes John, Apostles John and Paul, but Pope John the 23rd is what.
So, evidently, this was an extraterrestrial meeting?
Yes, yes. It was first reported by his personal assistant, Loris Capovilla, and he was there, this Mr. Capovilla, when it happened. And in the, what did you say it was? In the summer of 1961, I think the Pope was at his summer residence Castel Gandolfo in Italy, and as they were taking a stroll through the garden of the castle, they saw this strange object, aerial object, hovering overhead, which landed at the far end of the garden. And the Pope, also known as the Good Pope, because he was very popular and many miracles have been ascribed to him, healings, told his assistant to stay put as he walked towards the craft, from which they had seen a being coming out. And the being had been signaling the Pope to come closer. So he asked his assistant to stay put, and the Pope went over. And at one point, the assistant, Mr. Capovilla, saw the Pope kneel down. And as he returned, the Pope spoke those words which I quoted. Sometimes we have difficulty recognizing our own brothers. Yeah, the sons of God are everywhere, he says, but sometimes we have difficulty recognizing our own brothers.
I'm surprised there has not been more said about this. This meeting between the Pope and this, what appeared to be an extraterrestrial human, I think it would be very helpful for many of us to learn what was said, what the discussion was between the Pope and this human, this extraterrestrial human.
Yeah.
Why do you think?
Don't know if there's any more known of what was said. Mm-hmm. I mean, this came to us through Capovilla, Mr. Capovilla, and it was only when a bishop in, where was it? Was it in Peru? Yes. Higinio Alas sort of gave it some more publicity, so to speak, and then it was picked up by some media in the West, in Europe, but that's about it.
Very interesting. It almost makes me wonder how many of these kind of contacts have gone on.
Yes, it makes you wonder, doesn't it? And, well, the interesting thing is, one, Pope John the 23rd is the same Pope that Adamski, George Adamski, one of the foremost contactees from the 1950s, went to meet a few days before the Pope's death in 1963. And they had some exchange, and Adamski had a letter for the Pope that he was asked to take to him, a letter from the space people that Adamski had met earlier on his tour of Europe in Copenhagen. But on the other hand, you know, I've collected some, I've described some similar experiences in that same book, Here to Help, which involved, for instance, Kirsten Ilyumzevich. I'm sorry. I don't remember his name now. This is really embarrassing. But
no,
it's
that's
in my
okay.
book. He's the president of the World Chess Federation and the former president of the Southern Russian Republic of Kalmykia.
Mm-hmm.
Ilyumzinov. That's his name, Ilyumzinov. So that's another, you know, high-standing individual. Not everyone agrees with his policies, either in politics or in chess, but he's also one who stepped forward and told the media quite openly about his experiences. We have several other examples now. Most recently, former president and current prime minister of Russia, Medvedev. There's the Bulgarian astronomer Professor Filipov, who was stripped of all his positions, apparently, in the Bulgarian Space Agency or astronomical agency for speaking out about his solid conviction that there is contact, that we are being visited, and there is contact. And, you know, we have Paul Hellyer, of course, the former defense minister of Canada. And the list goes on.
In 1985, there were six crew members on board the Soviet Salyut 7 space station. They were the cosmonauts Leonid Kizim, Oleg Atov, Vladimir Solyov, Svetlana Savitskaya, Igor Volk, and Vladimir Janabekov. That day, the cosmonauts were doing their routine work connected with laboratory experiments. All of a sudden, a cloud of strange orange gas enveloped the station. A flash of bright light blinded all the cosmonauts on board for a while. As soon as they could see again, the cosmonauts saw silhouettes of seven figures outside the station. These extraterrestrials looked like humans, but they were much larger. They had wings behind their backs and luminous halos above their head. The creatures look like angels. Can you comment on that event, Gerard?
Well, I quoted also in my book as an example of how human consciousness is growing, has grown especially over the last 150 years, more or less. I don't know more about it. I didn't even know the names of the cosmonauts that you just mentioned. But it was rather well published at the time. I believe it was around 1986 when the story came out. And the cosmonauts, as they're called in Russian, astronauts in American English, they had an experience of say a higher reality, and of course for most of us it's just speculation what it could have been. It's not likely they would have taken psychedelic mushrooms on board with them. there are people like Benjamin Krem who has been trained by a master of wisdom. You said you want to talk about the ages wisdom teaching, but there we go already. Benjamin Krem has been trained by a master of wisdom since 1959. He also happens to have been a contactee in the 1950s before he started his work with the masters. And he explained that this was an experience given to the cosmonauts by the master who still goes by his best-known name, the Master Jesus, as he was Jesus, the disciple Jesus, 2,000 years ago in Palestine. But he has been a master for a long time already. This was meant as one in an endless string of manifestations, signs, and miracles to give the cosmonauts an experience of higher realities. And at the same time, points out through these cosmonauts to humanity this reality and the fact of the return to the world of the world teacher, the master of all the masters, that is who is expected in all the major religions under different names, but they're all the person that they're expecting is basically the same individual.
I don't know if you know this or not. I did some more research on this, but those seven strange beings with the giant wings were also allegedly photographed by the Hubble telescope. And there's John Pratchett, an engineer of the Hubble project, said that he had seen those creatures that we were discussing earlier, and they were some 20 meters tall, and their wings spread could be compared to the length of a modern jetliner. Again, these are things that you'd think the UFO community would talk about a little more.
Yes, well, we have, of course, recently since the last couple of years, the photographs, if that's what you can call them, from the solar heliographic something, I don't know if it's a satellite. Yeah, it's a satellite, I imagine. Or is it an Earth-based instrument? I don't really know. That takes those photographs of the sun and solar activity. And 2 or 3 years ago, there was this huge uproar in the media, you could say, because it seemed to show an angel. Some people call it a UFO. Those are pictures, as Benjamin Graham has confirmed, of huge angelic beings. Besides the human evolution, there's also an angelic or diva evolution. They're called divas in the East. Hmm. And you remember these photographs? They're mainly red, and then there's the sun is blotted out, so you can see the solar activity. And there's this rather prominent creature or craft or structure-like appearance next to the sun. And according to Benjamin Graham, that was a deliberate manifestation, visible manifestation of a large, huge diva or angel, at the request also of the masters, all to awaken humanity to the reality of the spiritual realities of life, let's say. So, oh, here it is. Soho. What's it called again? The soul. Yes.
The pictures or the photographs, this thing near the sun that you're talking about, was that like only a couple years ago?
Yes, and it continues. It continues. Let me see if I can quickly find the full name of the thing. The short name is SOHO, S-O, but it's an abbreviation, S-O-H-O.
Well,
as you can hear, I'm not at my best at the moment.
Oh, that's okay.
Normally,
right.
I would just spit it out.
That's okay.
Oh, here it is. It's the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory.
Oh, really?
That's SOHO, yeah. And if you look for that, and use that, for instance, in conjunction with Angel or UFO, you'll get these photographs that seem to be occurring more and more. And, of course, SOHO and NASA are denying that it's anything out of the ordinary, except they don't have an explanation. Well, they give these explanations like, camera flare or things like that. But
Right. They've always got to give.
It's probably a weather balloon that got out of course or something.
A weather balloon orbiting the sun right now. Yeah. Now I this is something I found on another website, and I don't know exactly how reliable this is, but it corresponds to some other things I've heard. In December 26, 1944, the Hubble telescope transmitted allegedly 100 photos depicting a large white city floating in space. U.S. authorities did not expose the photos to the general public, of course, although it was rumored that U.S. officials treated NASA's report very seriously. I have another guest, a friend named Henry Kroll, who talks about these flying cities people have spotted before. And I think this concept even goes back to Vedic writings. Are you familiar with the whole flying cities thing?
Not so much in the sense of the folklore that seems to be in existence, but I have heard of giant UFOs, extraterrestrial craft, and I think it was in one of George Adamski's writings where he speaks of flying cities. So
wow.
Not an unknown phenomenon. Can I just ask, what year did you say this happened?
I think it was in 1994.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, yeah, no, I'm not familiar with this report about these photographs, but the concept itself, yes, I've heard of it before. It's not a new. Anything new to me in that sense.
There is another fellow you talk about in your book named Alberto Perego, I think, and there's a photograph.
Alberto Perego. Perego.
Perego. And he has a photograph of an extraterrestrial that was taken, I guess, when he wrote his book. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, Alberto Perego was a consul for the Italian government. So he was a diplomat, like an ambassador to many countries during his career all over the world. But he was also very much interested in the phenomenon of flying saucers, as they were still called then in the 1950s. I think his first book was published in 1957. And in fact, he was one of the more prominent members of what has come to be known as the Italian Friendship Case. There's a beautiful dramatized documentary about the Friendship Case on available for free on YouTube. It was published on YouTube by UFO TV, but it was actually an Italian production, but also available in English. And the Friendship Case involved hundreds of Italians, prominent and ordinary, who were contacted by extraterrestrial visitors who had their bases, underground bases, in around Italy and around Europe, in fact. There were other chapters, so to speak, going on in Germany and other European countries, even in Russia, it seems. And Alberto Perego, before this, before this is a Friendship Case started in 1956, had a profound interest in the subject, and he was collecting all these clippings and from around the world about flying saucer sightings, etc. And he published books about them. Being a member of, being a participant in the Friendship Case, he also had access to photographs that were made. He didn't make these photographs himself, maybe I shouldn't say that because I'm not entirely sure. But if he didn't make them himself, it was someone in the same group of participants in the Friendship Case, and he published them in two of his books. There were three photographs of extraterrestrial pilots, and two were in one book, and one was in another book. And I was lucky enough to come across those books and to be able to find and obtain copies of them, because they're increasingly rare. Reproduce them in my book, Here to Help, for posterity. Because, I mean, naturally, with most of the, until fairly recently, most of the interest in the UFO phenomenon coming from the United States, a lot of focus has been on North America. But a lot has been going on in Europe, especially Italy, and as we now know, in South America as well. So it's really, I thought it was really important. From Alberto Perego's books, I reproduced several photographs of the interior of a flying saucer.
Yeah.
And these have never been seen outside his books before I reproduced them in my book. So I'm really happy that I managed to that I found them and could use them.
And again, two people that are just not talked about much in the mainstream UFO community, Professor Bruno Samothisia and Stefan Breccia. I guess there are two major contactees in this friendship case. Can
yes,
you tell us
are,
a little
yeah.
bit about them? Why don't you tell us a little
bit
about
them? Bruno Samesizia was also one of the first ones to be involved. I think he was actually the among the first three people who were contacted in what became the friendship case. And he was a professor, a psychologist, if I'm not mistaken, and a theologian. He and two of his friends were mysteriously directed to a place. I say mysteriously because if you read the description in Stefano Breccia's book, Stefano Breccia later joined the group around these extraterrestrial visitors that allowed themselves to be contacted, and he basically wrote the book Mass Contacts that includes Bruno Samesizia's story. But Samesizia was the first among the first three who were contacted. And there's a beautiful description where Samesizia and his two friends were studying a map of a nearby place, and a pencil or a pen flew out of its holder and pointed to the map somewhere and started writing on a piece of paper and giving them instructions or something. And so they went over to that place a few days later, and from behind the wall they heard a voice, "Are you ready?" And "Are you ready to meet us?" And then came out a very tall extraterrestrial and a very short extraterrestrial, and they both spoke in Italian. And it started from there. And Stefano Breccia also had an academic or a technical career. I'm not entirely sure now. So these are also people that are not easily misled or conned or anything,
right.
Which
I think is
quite important.
Yeah, I think that Bruno Samesizia was a professor and Stefan Breccia was an engineer, I think.
Yes,
they were very credible people.
Absolutely. And there were many other credible people involved in the friendship case that I also quote in my book.
And what I like about these cases is these are conscious contacts that occurred face-to-face. What we have now are, I don't know, people are being regressed. They think they remember things. Things come out in the regression. You know what I'm saying. It's all...
Yes,
it's all really fuzzy to me. What are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, those are very subjective experiences that to be honest, sometimes quite frankly hard to believe. it's a pity that they take so much attention from the public, from people who are interested in the subject, because there are so many face-to-face contacts that there have been. In the 1950s, it started really with George Adamski, Truman Bethlehem, Howard Menger, and a whole range of others whose books I've been reading now in research for my next book. And the interesting thing is that a lot of what these people have said corroborates. So, and at the time, they didn't know each other. You know, Adamski was the most famous one, and he was, you know, his books were reprinted many times over within a couple of years and translated into dozens of languages. There was no internet, there was no email, and there were still large swathes of the U.S. where people would not have heard of him, people who had their own experiences. But the interesting thing is, of course, we know what happened when huge audiences were drawn by Adamski's message and the message from the other contactees, you know, messages of exhorting humanity to denounce nuclear power, nuclear weapons, take an inclusive approach to other countries and to work together to get through this difficult time, and that this was during the Cold War. We know that triggered the disinformation campaign. The disinformation campaign was organized and orchestrated. Who knows? You know, secret government agencies. Let's keep it at that. Whether they were military or government or both doesn't really matter. But they did succeed in really poisoning, polluting the public mind about the extraterrestrial presence. And ever since that disinformation campaign took hold, we can't really be sure of whether accounts, people's experiences are true or not, authentic or not. We know there are documented cases of people who were given experiences through drugs or hypnosis. And, of course, then we know that they were not ET-related. But the interesting thing is that the information coming from the contactees, the early contactees from before the disinformation campaign, is now being corroborated by these dignitaries and officials who come out with their stories, like Kirsan Ilyumzinov, who says they are people like us. They have, they think like us, and they want the best for us. Wilbert Smith, the Canadian researcher, who was convinced that they're here to help, to share their technology, etc., not to take over, not to conquer or anything, because as Adamski also said, you know, if they had wanted to conquer this planet, why would they have waited for so long until we had destructive weapons ourselves? They would have done that ages ago. And as I listed in my book, Here to Help, there's a whole string of these public figures with the same or similar experiences. So, you know, we don't really need the very subjective experience. Of course, many people like to have their own experiences, and I can understand that. And some people will come up with them, with these experiences from, you know, just based on their desires. Other people, unfortunately, have been misused. And some people may well have had some authentic experiences, but there's no way other people can know that. And for me, an experience is only worthwhile in the sense of, you know, being possibly authentic or not, if it is corroborated, or at least parts of the experiences are corroborated by the early contactees, by the later contactees, the dignitaries and officials, but also, you know, the core of our religions, the shared wisdom tradition of humanity.
I think Alexandria David Neal was one of the early influences on Benjamin Krem. She wrote over 30 books on Eastern religion and philosophy. Can you discuss her at all?
I'm afraid not really. I have her book. I haven't been able to read it yet, but I do know from Benjamin Krem's description that she was a French explorer, adventurer, a woman who managed to get into Tibet at a time when it was a really isolated country, and it was really not done for ladies to travel by themselves. But she managed to get into Tibet, and she was accepted into some Buddhist order monastery. And she was trained there in all kinds of yogic abilities. And one of the things that she managed to do at some point was to materialize a familiar, an astral being, so to speak. But because she wasn't an adept like some of the monks she was training with, the familiar got out of hand, got out of her control, and had to be eliminated by the other Buddhist monks. That's the extent of what I know. But she's one of many people who went to Tibet and worked or studied there with the masters. And you may remember from my first book about George Adamski that George Adamski as a teenager went to Tibet and studied with the masters. There's an, you know, his first book was called Wisdom of the Masters of the Far East. There is a very well-known author called Bertie Spaulding, and his book, Life and Teaching of the Masters of the Far East, was very popular ever since and has been and still is very popular among seekers, and I believe that's also authentic. You know, it was perhaps not all the experiences were on the dense physical plane, but they were authentic experiences. There's one originally Canadian writer, and he was a medical doctor, Rolf Alexander, who went to Tibet in 1938, and his best-known book, The Power of the Mind, includes some of the practices that he was taught for detaching, some kind of self-hypnosis even, according to Benjamin Cram. And he's written several books. In the original American edition was called Creative Realism, but the British edition is much better known, and it's called The Power of the Mind. And one more example of people who went to study and work with the masters was Murdo MacDonald Bain. He was a Scottish doctor. And after his experiences in Tibet in 1937 and 1938, he went around the world. He's been to New Zealand, I believe, Australia, South Africa, and Europe, giving lectures. He was often overshadowed by the masters during his lectures, giving messages or lectures. There's a whole volume with lectures by the Master Jesus through Murdo MacDonald Bain. So, you know, it's a fairly... not really common in the everyday sense, but it is a an experience that has been shared by several people.
There's another lady named Alice Ann Bailey. She was a writer and a theosophist in occult teaching who also had influence on Benjamin Krem. At age 15 in 1895, Bailey was visited by a stranger, a tall man dressed in European clothes and wearing a turban, who told her she needed to develop self-control to prepare a certain work plan for her to do. And I wonder, do you think that this individual may have been what they call the Maitreya or the world teacher?
It could have been. It could also have been one of the other masters. Alice Ann Bailey, of course, is well known in esoteric circles, in circles of the students of the Ageless Wisdom teaching, and indeed a major inspiration for Benjamin Krem as well. Alice Bailey worked as an amanuensis. But she worked for the master, the Tibetan master, called Joel Kuhl, and she did so from 1919 until her death in 1949. And she wrote some 19 volumes. Many of these started as brochures, pamphlets, to be sent to people who were studying with her in a study group, but all with the ultimate aim of being published in books. So she wrote 19 for the master, Joel Kuhl, and she wrote a further 6 volumes by herself without the, not the master not dictating them. The other 19 were dictated by the master, Joel Kuhl. And they are works of profound esoteric knowledge. They're actually elaborations on the teachings that first came through Helena Blavatsky from 1875 onward. They are different stages in the teachings for the New Age. Blavatsky was the one, the disciple who first posited the idea of the evolution of consciousness and the existence of the masters of wisdom as the next kingdom in nature up from the human kingdom. You know, the kingdom of souls has evolved out of the human kingdom. And the kingdom of souls, of course, is populated by the masters of wisdom, who are human beings like us. They're people like us. but they have gone ahead of us on the path of return, the path of evolution. And at the end of an individual's, and the end of a soul's cycle, endless cycle, it seems, of incarnations, in the last, you can't put a hard number on it, but for some people it's fewer than for others. Last number of incarnations, we go through what are basically crises of consciousness, and they are called initiations. And there are five on this planet that make you a master of wisdom. So from the first initiation until the fifth, you're on the path of discipleship, and at the fifth initiation, you actually enter the kingdom of souls, or the great white brotherhood, or the spiritual hierarchy of masters on this planet. And these five initiations were symbolized in the New Testament, in the Gospels, in the life of Jesus, from the birth of the Christ principle in the heart of the human being, symbolized by the birth in the cave or in the stable, through the baptism in the River Jordan as the stage where you control the emotional, astral part of your being, of your lower nature, through the and that was the second initiation. The third initiation being the Transfiguration on the Mount, where you achieve control over your mental nature. And the fourth initiation, symbolized by the crucifixion in the East, known as the Great Renunciation, which we saw in the life of Buddha, and where he renounced all the riches and wealth and power, etc. And that sort of completes the control over the combined lower nature, the detachment of our individualized consciousness from the bonds of dense physical existence, and finally the resurrection being the symbol for the fifth initiation, where the soul stands free as a master over his lower self. And from there on, there are higher paths of evolution outside of this planet. Some masters stay on to oversee, inspire, help the rest of us. And of course, they work closely with the brothers and sisters from space, from the other planets in our system. And Alice Bailey has given, or the Master Joel Kuhl actually, through Alice Bailey, has given us unbelievable amount of information on all this. Very interesting perspectives on history too. One of the volumes is called the Externalization of Hierarchy. That's what it's called, and it's actually a very esoteric view of contemporary history, especially the last century with the Great Wars, the First and Second World War, which were seen by the masters as one great war that went underground in 18 or 19, when the First World War ended or was declared over, and came back up again in 1939, and that was actually the workings of the Antichrist to prepare the way for the Christ, or the world teacher. Christians expect the second coming of Christ, and that's basically the return of the world teacher. At the beginning of every new cosmic cycle, we have a world teacher sent out from the spiritual hierarchy, from the master, the masters, and the Antichrist did its work of destruction, because that's what the Antichrist energy does. It destroys, it destroys to make way for the new energies. And the new energies of Aquarius are now, according to Benjamin Krem's information, are now have since 2009 been dominant. They're not at their height yet, but they're now stronger than the old energies of Pisces. And of course, your listeners will know, you will know because you've interviewed Benjamin Cram, I believe, that he says that since 1977, the world teacher has been in the world, and his personal name is known, has been known to the Buddhists because they've been expecting Maitreya Buddha, the fifth Buddha. And Maitreya is the personal name of the world teacher. And he's been in the world since 1977. That was a bit later than he had initially hoped. He had hoped to return around 1950, but in that time, as we know, yeah, the Cold War, was really on, and the old antagonist, or yeah, the whole power play in the world had started again, and it was an enormous psychological division, ideological division in the world. If that hadn't happened, you know, we would have had the world teacher in our midst since 1950 roundabout. But he postponed his return. He took up his place in the modern world in 1977. He was ready to step forward in 1982. And unfortunately, the media at the time, who were present at Benjamin Cram's press conference in Los Angeles, sometime in April, I believe, did not respond significantly enough. So Maitreya decided to wait, because for him that was a sign that humanity wasn't ready yet. And one thing the masters will never do, and the space people will never do, is infringe our free will. They will never do that. I mean, I've heard many people have asked me, well, you know, why don't they just show up? Yeah, whether it's the masters or the space people, why don't they just land in the gardens of the White House? Why don't they just take over? They know how to do it. We don't, and we're destroying the planet. Why don't they just do that? But they know that, first, we wouldn't like to be told what to do. You know, it would not change us at heart. We need a change of heart, but we have to change ourselves, because you cannot... recent example, you know, the Americans and the British went into Iraq, guns blazing, to bring democracy and freedom. Well, what we have is more terror now. You know, so you can't change people by force. The change has to come from inside. And the masters know that better than anyone. The space brothers know that better than anyone. So they will never infringe our free will. But, you know, humanity is responding more and more to the energies of Aquarius, and at the same time, the tensions in the world have been building up to the point where the masters call it the sword of cleavage, and Maitreya has called it the sword of cleavage, where we can see very, very clearly now the choice before us, and it will become clearer once I would think in the second part of this year the economic financial structures start their final collapse. You know, it started a long time ago in Japan in 1988, and every time the powers that be manage to build up the facade again to make us think that everything is back to normal and business as usual, but we're now at the point where, you know, the insiders, the people who know, they know that it's no longer tenable, and sooner rather than later, the whole business will come crashing down. And that will bring humanity in general to the point where we can see very clearly the choice before us. Either we continue on the way of the path of greed and competition and conflict and chaos and ultimately self-destruction, or we choose to cooperate, to share the bounty of this world and the produce and the technology and everything that we have, to make sure that every man, woman, and child has adequate food and housing and healthcare and education. And so build justice in the world and make sure that, you know, all the tensions will disappear. Justice and respect and freedom for everyone, because, you know, we cannot afford a major international conflict anymore. There are still too many nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction, not in the places where we looked in 2002, but they are there, you know. And one push on the wrong button will set into motion this whole what you call that chain of events that will lead to the destruction of the planet and humanity. In any case, so that's what's happening now. And Alice Bailey made a magnificent, a terrific contribution to this knowledge. She elaborated on the teachings by Helena Blavatsky, and Benjamin Cram sort of brought it into perspective and updated everything that Alice Bailey has said.
That's very interesting. Did you say we will have a financial collapse at the end of this year?
Well, I've been expecting it. I'm surprised that the whole thing didn't come down in 2008, and that they managed to erect, well, at least the facades again. But of course, we all know who paid for that. That was us, the taxpayers. But if not in the second half of this year, then the beginning of next year, because even the analysts and the economists and everybody knows that this is the end game. It's over. Actually, it's not the end game. The game is over. We're running on printing money that, for which there is no collateral, there's no gold supporting that or anything. So we're creating our own debts. We're digging ourselves deeper into the hole every day through the solutions that our politicians, etc., come up with. So it's completely untenable, and it's a complete. We're living a complete lie, a complete illusion at the moment. So it must come down.
Very, very interesting. Gerard, is there any thoughts or ideas that you wanted to leave our listeners with today that we haven't covered?
I think the main gist of my information, my story, and of course I'm very much indebted to Benjamin Cram's books, Alice Bailey's books, and the books by the contactees. The main gist of the information that I hope listeners will take away from this program is, that things will get worse in the very near future, I expect. But it is, it has to get worse before it gets better. And we will be presented by a major choice that I just described, which I'm sure everyone will recognize when they're making that choice, because that will be at the time that the world teacher, Maitreya, is declaring himself to the world on the Day of Declaration. And it will be a worldwide television broadcast, which everyone will be able to see if they care to switch on the TV and experience. And, it is ultimately a message of hope, message of limitless hope for humanity. It's not that the masters or the world teacher are here to save us. They're here to help us. We created these problems. We have to solve these problems. But they are here to help. They are here to inspire, not only, but also share with us their wisdom and their technology and propose solutions that we can, we can accept or reject. But I'm very, very hopeful that the crisis that is unfolding almost in front of our eyes now in the coming time is really the breaking of the shell of the egg, that has been forming around us through the petrified structures, the crystallized structures from the past civilization into the future. There's such a brilliant future ahead of us. So it's really a message of hope.
Please tell the listeners again your website.
My website is bgapublications.nl, And if they want more information, more info on Benjamin Cram and his message, they can go to share-international.org and find more information on the Return of the World Teacher and related subjects.
And tell us again your books, the books you've written.
Yes, my books are, the first one was George Adamski, A Herald for the Space Brothers. And it's very interesting because George Adamski, because he studied with the Masters, and his message really has always been consistent. And in my book, I compare that a bit to the Ageless Wisdom teachings, and then make a comparison with the teachings coming from the space people. And my second book is Here to Help, UFOs and the Space Brothers.
And you're working on a new book too, correct?
Yes, that's correct. I finished my research last year, but then I fell ill and I haven't been able to do very much. But I've started writing again, and I hope to publish it this summer. And it will actually be an exposé of the information that the space visitors have shared with their contactees, and the information they've shared on alternative ways of organizing society. They haven't just been, you know, asking people to make known that they are here, but they've also been very concrete in, have been taking people to their planets, have been informing some contactees about life on their planets, from which we have a lot to learn if we want to survive, if we want to, you know, our civilization to progress. It's very interesting. Before I started, I didn't know there was so much information available. And I hope to get as much as possible of it in my new book. It's really about the priorities that we need to be setting for the new time.
It seems like the current structure of our economy and our governments is a structure that overemphasizes profit, where we instead should be emphasizing the well-being of all people and also the well-being of the planet, because it seems like so many of our technologies, whether it's, you know, the nuclear industry is probably the worst, and then even the oil industry, all of these technologies, we're destroying the very planet that we're living on. So we have to literally change our whole society. Don't you agree?
I couldn't agree more. And you know, it's indeed the economic system that keeps millions of people from reaching their potential. In fact, it has let people die, starve literally for at least 60 years. People that perhaps don't live around the corner from us, but they live on the same planet. You know, and there's been a wealth of produce, etc., and more, especially since the rise of neoliberalism through Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher in the UK, you know, more and more of that wealth has been going into fewer and fewer hands. So it's like humanity is being squeezed, all the life of humanity is being squeezed out of it, because the completely skewed and corrupted system that we allow ourselves to live in.
Well, thanks for coming on again, Gerard. I hope we talk again soon. It's always such a wealth of information, sir. Have a great day.
Thank you very much for having me, Mark. You have a good day, too.
All right, we'll see you. Thanks. Thanks, folks. Thanks for listening. This is Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder, and we'll be on. We'll be on freedomslips.com tonight on Revolution Radio Studio B. Talk to you all later.